Well, thank you for inviting me. It's always a pleasure to come to the UK and Scotland in particular. It's a long time I've been in Edinburgh, and yesterday night when I arrived, a lot of memories came back when I visited Edinburgh with my parents when I was 16, so I'm very ashamed that it took so long for coming back. I'd like to share with you some of the work we've been doing the last 15 years on mechanisms that may explain why some people are more disturbed by pain, why pain is more interfering with their daily lives than other people. See, this works, yes. So I would like to share with you, just to start with a conceptual issue. What is, how can we look at pain? And I would propose that pain is one of these mental representations. Then going to the issue of the threat of pain, the threat value, and the variations in threat value of pain. I know it's about assessment, but it's very difficult to talk about assessment and not talk about the management. So it's linked together. So I will lift a tip of some of the management issues as well, and the effectiveness, and then start with some conclusions. So first, pain as a mental representation. I hope I'm not shocking people. Well, 20 years ago, if you would tell something like that, it would provoke a lot of disconcert and a lot of worry and a lot of opposition, I guess. It's interesting to see that in the literature, in the pain literature, that more and more you see that there's more conversion of different conceptualizations, which is very nice. Well, this is a traditional disease model, as you know, where the key issue is that behavior and pain behavior and what people do in pain are almost a direct reflection of something going on in the body, a stimulus. So there's a direct relationship between stimuli and the behavior. And we know that's a very simplistic view of human behavior. And I would like to illustrate this with a very simple experiment. And it's not about pain, it's about visual perception. And you probably know this experiment. Please look at this. What do you see? Yeah, of course, I'm sure that you all see two parallel red horizontal lines. Now, I'm not going to change anything about these lines, but I'm just going to change the context. So we will modify the surrounding context without modifying the two lines. And please look at the lines and see what happens. Suddenly, these lines are not parallel anymore. And they seem to be bulging a little bit. This is a very simple experiment, and you've seen many of these visual illusions, which shows that we're not seeing the lines anymore. What we see is the mental representation of the lines, and the mental representation is not the same as the stimuli. Its mental representation is being modified by a lot of factors, such as contextual factors. And this is a very simple experiment with very obvious stimuli, visual stimuli, which you can measure. You can measure the thickness of the lines, the length, the color, you can describe it very well. But what happens with other perceptual phenomena, such as body perceptions, which are much more difficult, much more vague, and you can imagine that these contextual factors may have more room to play than in visual perception. And it's a very nice experiment of one of my colleagues. It's very similar, but this time with pain. He took a metal bar and cooled it down to minus 25 degrees and put it for a second on the back and the neck of healthy subjects. And then asked a lot of questions about, with visual analysis skills, about the sensations that these subjects felt. That was a manipulation, an informational manipulation. So in half of the subjects, they were told that a very cold bar would be put on the neck. In the other half, it was told that a very hot bar would be put on the neck. Okay, but the stimulus was exactly the same. And one of these questions was the painfulness of the stimulus. And what happened was that the painfulness of the stimulus was rated much higher, significantly higher, in those who were told that they would receive a hot bar compared to those who were told to be exposed to a cold bar. And why is this? Well, he did also some mediation analysis, and the difference was that the hot bar was perceived as more dangerous, more harmful than the cold bar. And this information mediated the relationship between the stimulus and the painfulness. So again, the same stimulus, different response because of the context, in this case, the instructional context. So the first conclusion is the simple Cartesian model is not, actually it's for recycling, not for recycling, sorry, it should be thrown away. Well, it's probably too extreme. And this comes from a very nice book, which some of you may know, Explain Pain by... yes, exactly. I forgot the name. Thank you very much. So, it's not the stimulus that causes the behavior, it's the mental representation of the stimulus that actually modifies our behavior. And we see a lot of examples of this. And we know these situations, contexts, in which nociception does not lead to suffering or pain behavior. This is the left one is in India, a ritual very important for this young man to be able to participate because it's a transition to adulthood. And not only in non-Western culture, this is a picture, the right one, from, it's in Norway, it's also an association of young people. They, on Friday night, they come together and they hook themselves put themselves these hooks and then sit in lotus position and then are being lifted 1 meter off the floor. And also there are no signs of pain behavior or suffering. So the threat value of pain, so this seems to be, the context seems to be able to modify when pain is something threatening or when pain is just belonging to the context and something which is not very threatening at all. And this is probably a picture you may have seen also. It's from, it was displayed, this picture, in London, also in the College of Physicians a couple of years ago. Actually, it's a shoe of a worker, construction worker, and he was on a scaffold, and it was time for lunch or shift change, I don't know. He jumped down and didn't see that there was a piece of wood with a nail, and he jumped right into the nail, and so the nail pierced his shoe. So he was screaming, he was really in great distress, was taken by his co-workers, put into the bus and directly to the hospital. They was given anesthesia, went to the operating room, and then they tried to remove very carefully the shoe. And what did the doctor discover? That the nail went very nicely in between the two toes without causing any injury. But did this man, did he feel something? Yeah, he must have felt something because these shoes are very strong. They have a metal reinforcement. So that he must have heard the nail pierce the shoe. Maybe he must have felt the contact of the nail with the toe, with the skin of the toe. But the interpretation of all this stimuli was my foot is being injured. And this context and this interpretation has led to a lot of suffering and a lot of behavior. This is probably an extreme case and almost the opposite of the previous ones, where pain is just part of the context. Now, the last one is probably a very nice example of pain catastrophizing, which was already mentioned by the previous speaker. And we have a very well-known now pain catastrophizing scale to measure the interpretation of the threat meaning that patients attach or healthy people attach to pain. It's a pain catastrophizing scale developed by Michael Sullivan from Montreal. And these are typical questions that you can ask. Well, it's a questionnaire. For example, I become afraid that pain will increase, or I wonder whether something serious might happen. It's not just, let's say, verbal report. There's some more and more studies coming up showing that also in the brain, things are changed, are different, different processes when catastrophizing people are compared with non or low catastrophizing people. And this is a study in Karen Davis' lab showing that for mild pain, that the high catastrophizers are associated with increased activity in the thalamus, for example, and other centers which are responsible also for pain processing. And for moderate pain, also decreased activity in centers that are responsible for inhibition of pain and other aversive sensations. Now, catastrophizing in most cases leads to emotional changes, and one of the most important emotional changes is that it increases fear. Catastrophizing and fear are very closely related. And when you see the situation as very threatening, then your first reaction will be fear. Because why fear? Because fear is actually a way of preparing you for defense. That's the function of fear. And then it's interesting to have a look at why fear develops and what the consequences of catastrophizing fear could be if you know more about the mechanisms of fear. Now, in fact, there are three ways how fear can develop into a chronicity, a chronic fear. And the first one, and that's the mostly researched one, is by a personal experience. When you experience some kind of trauma, and when you are exposed to a traumatic event. There are two indirect ways as well. I'm not going to talk much about that, but just to know that it's not the only one, that it's witnessing someone else being very fearful. That's what we call vicarious learning. And the third one is by instruction, by hearing that something may be dangerous. The first one is the strongest one, and the last one is the least strong. It seems that the more personal experience you have, the stronger the learning process. Associative learning. You all know Pavlov dogs, of course. And what happens actually, in principle, here also the dog learns something about the stimulus. The dog learns association between two stimuli, the light and the food. And after a while, because of this combination, the light is not light anymore for the dog. Actually, when the light goes on, the dog sees the mental representation of the food. That's what the light has become. So there's been a change in the representation of light. So that after a while, when only the light is being shown, then the salivation that normally occurs when the food is being given also is being elicited. So the light can elicit salivation. That's when learning has occurred, because of the association, because the light is not light anymore, but the mental representation of food. Now, go back to pain. Now, a possibility would be that we all know the nociception is associated with pain, depending on the meaning. That's what we have seen before. Now, also we can have associations between different kinds of stimuli. Nociception can be associated with a host of different other stimuli, initially neutral stimuli, such as interoception, proprioception, and in some cases also exteroception. In pain, we have looked especially in proprioception, because we know that movements are often associated with nociception and lead to pain. Now, what happens after a while, after this association, same as in Pavlov's dog, after a while, the interoception of proprioceptive stimulus, which can become conditioned stimuli and can elicit also the mental representation of pain. Also depending on the meaning, and the mental representation of pain, if it's threatening, and in most cases it will, then it will elicit a defense response. That's different from the Pavlov dog, which was an appetitive response, of course, salivation. In this case, it's the opposite. It's an aversive stimulus, and it will elicit a defense. And what is a defense response? It's increased arousal, increased attention to the source of threat, to be able to cope with it, and avoidance, escape from the situation. And in the acute phase, in the dangerous phase, it's very adaptive. The problem occurs when people continue using these defensive responses even in the absence of the threat. And then it gets paradoxical effects. Then you get all the disuse syndrome, and then you get a continuation of the fear. So that's what's happening after a while. And one example is what we call kinesiophobia, where a proprioceptive stimulus has become a conditioned stimulus, eliciting fear and eliciting these defense reactions. And people are not moving anymore. Now, some experiments underlying or corroborating this mechanism. There's a very nice study by Bradley. It's in Pain in Press, looking at arousal. What happens in the experiment, very briefly, is that in the acquisition phase, so we try to learn fear, two dots, a red one, I don't know the colors anymore, but two different colors. One color is associated with electric shock. The other one is a safe one, is not associated with shock. And there are several trials, so that the person learns to associate one color with shock and the other color not with shock. And then in the test phase, only the colors are being shown without a shock. And what you see then is that the color that was associated with the shock, the conditioned stimulus, the CS+, is associated with an increase in skin conductance, while the other color is not. Actually, the skin conductance remains the same. And this is moderated also by baseline levels of fear. So especially in the fearful people, you see that this kind of association elicits a lot of arousal. There's also a lot of work on fear and attentional processes. I'm not going in that subject today. The group in Ghent by Geert Combe and others have done a lot of very intriguing and exciting work on that. And the conclusion is that when you have pain and you are very fearful of pain, you're catastrophizing about pain, there are three processes going on, three components of the attention. First is this increased body scanning. Second is selective attention to where you think the problem is. And the last one, which is especially the one component that is interfering with your daily life, is the problem disengaging from the source of threat, the problem of disengaging from pain at the cost of other tasks that you have to do in your daily life. And the third one is escape and avoidance behavior. And this is one experiment that we have done a couple of years ago, that we invited subjects to the lab and showed them this video, and with the instruction, look very carefully to this, the woman in the with the blue t-shirt on the right, because when the video is finished, right now, you're going to do the same activity. So exactly, we're exposing the patients to a fearful activity, to the CS, the proprioceptive stimulus. And then afterwards we ask a lot of things, a number of things. First was the subjective tension during and after the exposure to the video. And you see that in the fearful ones, that during the exposure the subjective tension increases. And afterwards, we asked them to lift a weight, 5 kilograms, so not that backstretching activity, just lifting a weight, and you see that the fearful, they lift only half of the time compared to the non-fearful one. So there is escape from that situation. And the escape behavior was predicted only by gender, females stopping earlier than males, and by the threat value of the perceived threat value of this lifting activity, and not by personality, not by pain, and so on. So, in conclusion, the fear of avoidance model would predict the following, that pain may be caused by injury or strain or unknown factors, when the interpretation, and that's the accent, is the interpretation of the pain, when it's interpreted in a catastrophic way, then it leads to these fear and defense responses. And to, I don't like the word disuse and, so much, because we don't know exactly what disuse means, but you could say the consequences of continuously avoiding and putting attention to the threat can lead to disability. And there is increasing support for this model with many, many studies. So the question now is, can we do something about it? If we establish pain-related fear, is it possible to decrease fear? So what is the management of pain-related fear? Now, one possibility would be is to, and that comes from the bulk of literature on anxiety disorders, that one of the most powerful treatments is the prevention of the safety behaviors, the prevention of the defensive behavior, so that the individual is able to experience that the catastrophe does not occur So there is no need for being very defensive. So he needs to be exposed to the stimulus and then see that the catastrophe is not occurring. And that's what, for example, we do with spider phobics. It is very effective, very brief. So three steps: educate about a paradox of safety behaviors, of the defensive behaviors, tell people about the paradox, activate the fear network, so they need to be exposed to the stimulus, and then challenge expectancies so that they can change them, they can modify these. In one experiment with the group in Ghent did this, for example, with back pain patients, in being exposed twice to this kind of movement, the two-touch movement, and that baseline pain, expected pain and experienced pain. And the first trial, and that's very typical for people who are fearful, they overestimate the pain associated with the movement before they even do the movement. So you see that they expect more pain, and then when they do the movement, then you see that the experienced pain is a little less than what they expected, so there's an overestimation. Now what happens with the second trial? So they do it again, and then you see that there is a correction here, that the difference between the expected and the experienced is much less. So they have learned something. They have learned, yes indeed, it's not that bad, it's better than I thought. So they correct the overestimation. Clinically, actually we use the same principle, defining treatment goals, and then using a hierarchy, because it's very difficult to expose a person directly to the most threatening activity, and therefore we use photographs and from daily activities, and subjects are asked to rate those on a fear thermometer, with zero being I can do it without any problem, and 100 is this is very dangerous, very harmful for me, I'm never going to do this. And then the educational part, and then finally the exposure to, gradual exposure to all these activities following the hierarchy that was established by the patient. I'll show you in a minute. Hey, there is no sound anymore. There should be sound. Actually, it's Dutch, so you can just read the...
...to sort the photos on a scale of 1 to 100.
Pizza.
100 stands for the things she's scared to do.
Kratje met bier in dit geval uit de auto tellen die ik. Ik zie je steunen. Ja?
Ben je bier het alleen had? Ja, de gedachte alleen had. Ja,
kun je aangeven waarom je deze activiteit niet doet? Waarom?
Ja, ik ben gewoon bang dat er iets kapot gaat in mijn rug.
Bang dat er iets kapot gaat in je rug?
Ja.
Heb je al een idee wat er eventueel kapot zou kunnen gaan in je rug?
Ja, dan zouden bijvoorbeeld de wervels kunnen kapot gaan, spier kunnen knappen.
So that's the way how we work with the patients. And at the same time, it's also trying to get a hold on the mental representation of the stimuli, in this case proprioceptive stimuli, in a patient with back pain. And this takes about an hour, so it's a very intensive way, but very elucidating, because it gives a lot of rich data on these representations. There's also now a computer version, which if you're interested you can freely download from this site and install on your computer, where patients can drag the photographs with the mouse to the thermometer, and then the computer program calculates the hierarchy for you. And then the exposure itself uses the same material in a behavior experiment.
Heel bedreigend.
Als je het nou zou moeten aangeven op een schaal van 0 tot 100, waarbij 100 het meest bedreigend is,
90. Ja.
Als je dan zou kijken en je zou die activiteit moeten uitvoeren, je zou dat kratje, de bedoeling is dat je dan de achterbak van de auto gaat zetten, dat kratje, als je dat zou moeten doen, wat denk je dan wat er zou kunnen gebeuren? Hè?
Ja, ik denk dat er iets knapt achter in mijn rug, als ik die krat optil. Oké, en als er wat knapt, wat dan?
Als er iets knapt, dat zullen we dan doen. Wij hebben een kijkje van iets wat knapt, dat je echt dat aankan. Anders weten we deze activiteit niet doen.
Uithalen.
Laat
even
nog
even evalueren,
hoe vond je het gaan?
Ja, ik voel het gewoon heel hard trekken in mijn rug.
Oké, je voelt het trekken in je rug.
Maar heel erg.
Waar ik meer benieuwd naar ben, van, hoe is het met, je, met de wervelkolom? Is die gebroken? Is die knap?
Nee, natuurlijk niet.
Nee?
Nee. Maar ik was er wel heel erg bang voor.
Ja, ja. Ik denk dat het ook bedoeling is dat we meer eruit gaan tillen, hè? Of niet? Ja. Hey, knap hoor.
Oh, moet je kijken.
Ja. Echt heel knap, ja.
Oh. Hey.
So this was a patient with back pain from group 1, no specific low back pain. Although we have also experiences with the other groups as well, but then the activities are more matched to the possibilities of the patient and the range that is still possible. So I'm finishing with some of the data on the effectiveness of this kind of fear reduction approach, which is based on the exposure to the feared activities. And basically what you see is the following, that in an exposure, and these are ratings of fear of movement, baseline exposure, and then a regular exercise treatment, that you see a very steep drop of the fear levels when exposure is being introduced and not when the regular exercise is being introduced, because the exposure is really, as you see, also as a cognitive element in the sense that it challenges the ideas that this movement will cause, for example, a fracture in the back or whatever, the mental representation of the patient. Because it's a very steep drop, we wondered maybe it's just the educational part that already reduced the fear. So we tease these apart in one another experiment with education and then exposure in one group, and the other group education and then just regular exercise. And this is what happens with the fear levels. You see that education indeed reduces the fear levels. These are also daily measures, so it's repeatedly during a whole period. But during the exposure, you see a further drop of the fear levels. And here we also measured pain levels, and you see that pain levels also drop, but in a lagged fashion, so later on. In the exercise, education exercise, there is actually also a drop during the education, but then there is no further change anymore, and pain levels don't change much neither. We also did this in complex regional pain syndrome. It's because of the therapist, also you saw, sees a lot of CRPS patients and wanted to try and see, because he sees that a lot of fear, and especially fear of touching, fear of not so much movement, but also tactile stimuli, seems very strong in these patients. So what happened was that we also used the exposure treatment, but not movements, starting with touch and then increasing the touch and then to movements. So it takes a little more time. What happens in these patients, as you see, we need more time before the fear drops. These are the fear levels. Interestingly enough, the pain levels also seem to drop, also later than the fear levels, same as in the low back pain patients. And then when you're looking at functional ability, pushing a baby buggy and lifting a child, these are personalized. Then you see that when the fear levels drop, the patient is able to do this activity again. So the measure here is 10 is impossible to do and 1 is I'm doing it. Yes. And it's interesting to see that this activity can be done after the fear level drops, not after the pain level has been dropped. And the same with lifting a child, which is possible also after a fear level drop and not so much the pain level drop. This is the results of a first randomized controlled trial comparing exposure and just graded activity, and seeing that exposure is effective in reducing the threat value of movements. This is post-treatment and a follow-up, and this is using the photograph series, and this is not the case in graded activity. This is also a reduction, but it's a significant difference between the two conditions. And when you look at functional disability, the difference is smaller. We didn't reach significance, but also in favor, the difference are in favor of the exposure group. It's a very interesting, that's maybe something for discussion later on, that when you do single case experimental designs with a limited number of patients, we also see stronger results than a large scale randomized control trial, multi-center trial with a lot of therapists. This is another study, also in Pain in Press in Canada, similar comparison, exposure versus graded activity, looking at clinically significant changes, and then you see that in the exposure, there are much more patients with significant, clinically significant improvements, 70%, as compared to graded activity and a waiting list control. So similar results, actually. One problem with the exposure is that there is an asymmetry between acquisition and extinction. That means that you can fear develops very quickly. Even when looking at someone else being fearful can make you feel very fearful. But it's very difficult to reduce fear, and it's very context dependent. And that's an asymmetry which we are faced with the treatment. So you need a lot of repetitions, a lot of exposures, to be able to reduce fear. And what is actually learned during the extinction of fear is not unlearning the fear. What actually is learned is exceptions to the rule, and it means that you often can see relapse afterwards. People have a very conservative position. It's better to take the safe side. Well, if you want to know a little more about it, this is a book that Gordon Asmundson, Geert Trombe and myself edited in 2004. We will soon start with a new updated edition. It's Understanding and Treating Fear of Pain. I think I wanted to say a little about conflicts, but I maybe do this later on because I think we have to stop right now. So I will skip these. Yes, and the conclusion. And I would like to say that pain-related fear is a normal response, and I'm taking that out from the whole psychopathology context. It's a normal response to long-lasting pain, because pain, it's not normal that pain takes a long time. The defensive responses may have paradoxical effects, and that's very important. And what is another increasing difficulty is when you have conflicting goals, and that means that one goal can be to escape the danger. At the same time, you want to be not excluded from your social context as well. And a lot of pain patients are in this kind of goal conflict. In one sense, the primary goal is to protect them, but the secondary goal is also to belong to the group, to belong to the social context. And that conflict is also causing extra problems. So we are now also doing some studies looking at the effects of these kind of goal conflicts. I would like to acknowledge our team and thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.